We're living in extreme times when the big other is practicing a very radical form of anti-disestablishmentarianism. I never thought I'd be able to use that word actually in a discourse. But what it means is that the deep state and its puppet media and talking heads of the official party line have established a church. And it's the church of pseudoscience. And anyone who is against that establishment, they are against. And they will censor and eliminate, sometimes with extreme prejudice. So you are not allowed to have perspectives different from those which are accepted by the church as its dogma, whether that concerns the value of masks, of lockdowns, of the safe and effective injections, or going even deeper into germ theory, virology, and the whole question of medical science in its allopathic form. None of that can be questioned without suffering consequences of excommunication. Literally, you won't be able to communicate via the media or worse. But the party line is now expanded beyond simply the church of pseudoscience, and now it's the church of Russophobia. And so, you know, you have to be against everything and everyone Russian, whether it's Russian novels or Russian films or Russian music. It doesn't matter. They are now the villains who have been demonized, and you're not allowed to have any other opinion. So in a way, this is how a system extends its functioning in the face of massive contradictions. It represses the contradictions. It attempts to make them unseeable, unknowable by being ridiculed or completely eliminated, marginalized by the power of the hive mind to deter you from even being curious about other positions, because that would clearly put you in the camp of an enemy of the state. And so there is a hard line that is faced by everyone who begins to approach perspectives that are outside of the mainstream, and a kind of fear, a paranoid fear, not an entirely irrational one, that comes up for many people, because you're stepping outside the bounds of what is permitted to know. Well, the same thing that happens now in the external world happens also in the internal world, right? As above, so below; as without, so within. And so the ego today, in its current savagely self-fragmented form, cannot stand its own contradictions. And so it must repress them, and it must assert to itself a sense of certainty, even when it's completely not certain and could not be certain about its course of action. But that that feeling of not knowing is so unbearable, so horrifying, so dreadful, that one has to pretend one knows. And so that state of being the sujet supposé savoir, right, the one who is assumed to know is the position that the ego takes, which is what we call master's discourse, or what Lacan called master's discourse. This state is one in which you can question everything except your own perspective. Right? You can question everything except the belief system, which is the basis of your point of view. But you are not allowed to question your own point of view, because if you do, then the ego begins to shatter. It can't handle that kind of interrogation that makes it realize that its beliefs are imagined, that they have no basis in the real. And it's because every ego in its current form is based in the imaginary, and it's riddled with contradictions. It cannot face those contradictions without the fear of shattering, the fear of coming apart in a way that it could never put itself together, because there isn't a fragment that's free of contradictions that can integrate all of those. And so the ego becomes more and more hardened and defended against the truth and against the real, and its pseudo-reality tunnel becomes reinforced against any light coming in that would threaten its illusory certainty. We can see this in the way that the dharmas have unfolded in time. So we have the Adi Sanatana Dharma, which means ancient original Dharma, right, of the gods and goddesses of Sat Yuga. And in that time, there were no egos. And so the Dharma there was without contradiction, because there were literally no egos interrupting the dream that was the mind of God in its purity. And in Treta Yuga, you had a minor glitch of a differential between the real and the soul, but very minor, because the soul is still, as the moon is to the sun, capable of capturing the reflection of the light. Even though it's no longer the light itself, it's able to reflect it in a way that provides a unified field of consciousness that can grasp and work through the unfoldment of the phenomenal plane with a whole mind that's not yet split. And then in the later yuga, you get the arrival of the ego, dwapar, that means two powers. Now the soul and the ego are on separate platforms. And in Kali Yuga, the ego gains total dominance, and the soul is repressed, as is the real beyond the soul. And the ego then, as Kali Yuga develops, splits itself more. It fractures more and more, becoming more complex, and in its complexity, more capable of understanding complexity, which allows the development of technology. Because technology requires that ability to analyze the complexity. But what it loses is the real meaning of science, real meaning of knowledge, because it can no longer integrate its own consciousness in with the focus upon the objectivity of phenomena. The subject is repressed, and the focus is on substance, but substance only as in the form of matter, not the real substance, what is under matter, which is consciousness itself. And so we get a pseudoscience that cannot understand either consciousness or matter ultimately, because it doesn't understand the true nature of matter, but it can understand the particular interactions that happen within the field of consciousness that is a tiny sliver of the whole that is made up of the Higgs field, so-called, and the quantum unified field, which produces the illusion of a cosmos. However, as the ego fragments more and more, so does that cosmos. Things make less and less sense as the ego fractures more and more, and its own internal contradictions become more and more visible. We actually see that in the history of philosophy itself in the West. If we start with one of the early modern philosophers, Immanuel Kant, his whole magnum opus, The Critique of Pure Reason, was about how do we deal with what he called the antinomies of reason, which he discovered that when you try to think about anything and think it all the way through, how was the world created, what is consciousness, what's the relationship of mind to matter, and all of that, that you end up with a mass of contradictions, antinomies, paradoxes, but things do not make sense. And so the antinomies of reason become a real irritant in Western thought. And it's ultimately what destroys the whole philosophical tradition, which reaches a dead end in the 20th century. But first it has to go through Hegel, and Hegel comes to the conclusion that given the state of consciousness, there is no way to resolve contradictions. The contradictions will continue to come because that is the nature of the world. Reality as a world is inherently contradictory. You can't get beyond it. Kant was hoping that there was a way. Hegel said, no, there is actually no way. We have to accept that there are contradictions that are irresolvable in the world. But he did say there is one option, one possibility, which is the realization of what he called absolute spirit. And in absolute spirit, when that manifests, when your consciousness gains the intelligence of the absolute, all contradictions will be resolved, and that will be the end of history. Okay, and that was his prediction, his prophecy. but then you get to Kurt Gödel, who discovers the same fact, the same truth, is present in mathematics. Any mathematical system, any system of thought, will reach a point of failure, of either inconsistency or incompleteness or both, a point where you will not be able to answer a question. You will not be able to find any response except one that will be contradictory, that will make the whole system not make sense. And that's true of arithmetic, or it's true of trigonometry, or it's true of mathematics as a whole, and it's true of logic, the logos itself. And this is an extremely important development in the history of thought. However, there is one possibility, which is, again, the realization of the intelligence that is always beyond any system that it produces. It cannot be systematized because as soon as it is reduced to a definite system, that defining of the infinite will create an inadequacy. You cannot have completeness in any system, and that includes the system of language. So our own thoughts are subject to the same principle of contradiction. So we talked about the four dharmas, the three mentioned in the Mahabharata, and let's call it Satyoga Dharma. The Adi Sanatan Dharma is the Pravritti Dharma, that is the dharma that works for the first three yugas. It works fine. Okay, but when you get to Kali Yuga, it no longer works. Why? Because conditions have changed and the social order is now out of sync with the real. In Satyuga, there's no out of syncness. In Treta, there's just a minor bit that can be overcome. In Dwapar Yuga, you're able to balance the real and the unreal. But in Kali Yuga, there's no longer a balance. There's no longer a capacity to remain outside of a state of delusion. And so, if you try to uphold the pravritti dharma, you have to do it by repressing your own uncertainty and your own concern that you're wrong, right? So the one in pravritti dharma who tries to uphold the ancient principles, which of course now would include the caste system. So if you try to uphold the caste system, of course you are you'll be completely demonized. But any aspect of dharma that posits even a transcendent, a real, is no longer anything but a fantasy, in from the position of the social order and the big other. And you have a situation where you cannot maintain your certainty without a massive repression of your doubts. And so if you consciously then enter apadharma, which is that the dharma in times of distress, which requires a shift of frame of reference to recognize that, okay, I don't know for sure what's right. I don't know the best course of action, but I'll do the best I can. And I'll do the best I can based on inspiration, on tradition, on the Dharma that has proven to be time-tested, on whatever landmarks I can hold on to, even though I see them crumbling and less relevant. The signifiers are shifting over the signifieds. We can no longer express in our current language what we knew in other languages that no longer exist. And that's literally true. There are thoughts you cannot have in English or Spanish that you can have in Sanskrit or in other languages of earlier times. You literally cannot think them because the concepts are different and they come from a different frame of reference with underlying axioms. So the apadharma then shifts for those who recognize that they can't handle the uncertainty, the not knowing, and they shift into the nivritti dharma. Now, the nivritti dharma is the dharma of renunciation of the world. It says, okay, I see the contradictions in it. I see that it doesn't make sense. I see that all the pleasures that I want bring suffering. I see that it's not worth the game. I want out. I want liberation. But the nivritti dharma doesn't work for the very reason that there is an I that wants liberation. You see, that's the frame of reference that is still sufficiently in duality, that it's the belief that there is someone who must renounce to get out that must be renounced. Okay? But it cannot actually be renounced because anyone who renounces it is already then creating the I thought of a renouncer and therefore producing yet something else that must be renounced. So it becomes one of those infinite regresses. So it can't be renounced, but it can be erased. Okay? So the real sadhana is the erasure of the I thought and all the baggage that goes with it. But there is no one who does the erasing. It is simply the recognition that there's a blank slate behind everything that was written that cannot be superimposed upon. It's an emptiness that is inherent. And this is the dharma that doesn't have a beginning. It's not the ancient original dharma, and it's not the middle dharma or the final dharma. It's beginningless, and it's endless. But it is a dharma that doesn't belong to the plane that you either want to come into or get out of. It's that dimension of the real that is neither fully manifest but not either fully unmanifest. And it's that contradiction that is actually a paradox, that if we can hold both sides of that and recognize that the I that you are is not the I that is thinking, that that's only a representation that is producing an expansive holographic field, but the I that is actually projecting the light through the lens of those beliefs, those primary archetypal forms that produce a world and that become encrusted with further and further layers of belief and of imagery and of desire and fear, etc., cause the evolution or devolution of that world. But the actual self that is transcendent of thought is never touched by it. And from that place, the light, when the light is totally focused on shining into that plane of the world, it dissolves it through its shining itself. It's no one who's doing it. It is the light itself, which is why it is an act of grace, an act of God. But because God is the self, Shivoham is the ultimate principle, when that is accepted, then the mind itself opens up to its own self-transcendence, and the gift of grace then shines through. But there has to be a willingness for the ego to dissolve in the light without fear of its own disappearance. That's what has to happen in Sat Yoga. That's what Sat Yoga is. And it must begin with the questioning of your perspective as an ego. It must begin with the letting go of all perspectives, and never to mistake Sat Yoga for a perspective. It is not a perspective on reality. It is simply the questioning of perspectives until you have arrived at the real. The real cannot be described, and it's not a perspective, because once it is realized, once Shivoham is realized, Om Tat Sat is also realized, which means that all perspectives are both false, but they are also relatively true. To the frame of reference of anyone who has a perspective, within that frame of reference, it will be their truth, even though it's an utter illusion. And yet, it is true for them, you see. For them in that moment, it may shift in the next moment, it's not true even for them, because there is no them, because the ego shifts. It has a number of I thoughts. And one I thought believes this, another believes that, another believes something else. So the ego in its fragmentation is not a stable entity. But there is a capacity for a stable observation of the ego's games and its layered hide-and-seek between the various dissociated fragments that can never make up a whole. And it is inherently open to its own transcendence, because the consciousness that is projected through the thinking mechanism is always capable of withdrawing from it and realizing its absolute freedom. And that's what must be done, is the realization of freedom from a perspective, from a context, from a frame of reference. It's unframeable. And in that state, there is not only the bliss that comes from liberation itself, but the intelligence that has created this omnipresence of multiplicity, the reconciliation and resolution of all of that into absolute non-duality. But non-duality is also non-unity. It's very important that you not think that non-dual means everything is one. No, it's neither dual nor is it unified. The zero is both absolute multiplicity and absolute nothingness. And the two that seem to be opposites are actually the same. But that sameness is not the same as oneness. Why? Because you only know sameness from a perspective within difference. Otherwise, sameness is not recognizable as sameness. That's why we have to get to Kali Yuga, to the absolute delusion, in order to recognize the real. You couldn't recognize the light except in extreme darkness. And you can't recognize the truth of that which is utterly paradoxical except by being in a state of total contradiction. So that's why, as horrible as the world might seem to be at the moment, it's perfect. And it had to be exactly the way it has unfolded in order for awakening to become possible and, in fact, necessary. But necessary only to those willing to question their perspective on what they think is their own existence, but which is actually only a dream. So, that's enough, I think, for this particular satsang. But I hope that's useful to people. Not that you are people. But that the consciousness can grok that capacity for transcendence of its own thinking function in order to realize who you really are, what this is, what that signifier of the real means, because it doesn't ever show up either in the objective world or in the subjective world of the mind. Satyoga, therefore, because it's a questioning, that's the act of satyoga, is a questioning. For Ramana, the question is, who am I? And that's also our question. But you can also ask, what is all this? What is the real? But the point is, none of those questions can be answered in language. To find the answer to those primary questions that establish the basis of your capacity to think anything at all can only be established in absolute emptiness. But that's something you will have to discover by entering that emptiness. And the ego cannot remain in emptiness without dissolving. It becomes erased by the very act of trying to find out who it is, the realization that it is not who it thought it was dissolves it. And one has to have the courage to dissolve the unreal. So it's the love of the real that is the engine of the upper death drive. And if you're attached to the unreal, then you're in the lower death drive. And you can't switch from one to the other unless you can discern the unreal from the real and want the real much more than your ego wants the unreal. And it's only after you have the real that the realization comes that the real includes the unreal and is not different from it. So it's that non-difference that arises only after the transcendence of the unreal that enables samsara to become a kingdom of heaven instead of a hell realm. It enables samsara to continue as an expression of divine love, of beauty, of truth, of goodness, of purity, of heart, everything that is worth living for can be, will be, an aspect of the unfoldment of the world as soon as we no longer want to be in the world. As soon as we're willing to die to the ego, then the prize is the kingdom of heaven or liberation from the whole game. But first, there has to be the transcendence of the ego's illusion completely, without a trace that would bring you back into it. And it's that extinguishing, annihilation, as the Sufis call it, fana, that elimination of the ego, that is the goal of Satyoga and the ultimate achievement of the real, that turns the revolution of the new cycle into motion. The final revolution is the beginning of a new world. So I hope all of us are true revolutionaries and making that shift from the destruction of the unreal ego to the creation of beauty, of truth, of goodness, even though it will be in a fictional form because it's a dream. But it will be that dream that is the mind of God in its fullness.